Hello, welcome back to the Data Science Salon podcast. This is our space to speak with data science practitioners and leaders, as well as people from closely related fields. I'm your host, Hugh McCallum. In addition to my work as a consultant and writer in the AI space, I'm also senior content advisor here at Formulated By, which is the company behind the Data Science Salon events and this podcast. Now, there's no single path to the data scientist role. Practitioners come from fields as varied as software development, economics, and academia. Many people in that last group aren't really sure what it's like to transition from an advanced degree program into industry. To better understand this path, I met with Dr. Resham Sarkar, a machine learning expert who heads up personalization efforts at Slice, which is a company that's transforming the pizza industry. Now, before she started building ML around pizza, she completed a PhD in physics and then worked in insurtech. In this episode, we talk about what it was like for her to move from that physics lab into the data scientist's chair, how she found that first job, and those elements of her PhD experience that have proven especially valuable in her commercial machine learning work. I'm very happy that Dr. Sarkar took some time out of her schedule to share her journey with us, and I hope you enjoy. Thank you so much for joining us today. How are you?
I'm good, and thank you so much for having me here. This is going to be fun.
So let's talk a little bit about who you are and where you are and how you got here.
Oh, yeah, totally. So I'm Resham, and I have a PhD in physics. That's why I moved to the States. I moved here to do a PhD in atomic physics at Northwestern University. The great thing about that was that that's in Evanston, really tucked away from the rest of Chicago, but you get all the perks of being in Chicago, as in, like, you know about the bustling tech world, and you don't necessarily have to, like, you know, move over to the Bay Area or to any other places. So right after my PhD, I started working for a company called CCC Information Services, and they're a software services provider for some leading insurance companies, like auto and injury insurance companies. I worked there as a data scientist, who was their first data scientist on the casualty end of the business, and started leading a team a couple of years after, kind of made my switch from being an IC to being a manager. And now I work at a company called Slice that is helping digitize the world of orders for local mom and pop pizzerias, which I think, you know, is one of the hardest things for them to do and be able to compete with the big kahunas like Domino's or Papa John's. I lead the personalization and machine learning part of that company. So that's kind of been my journey from academia to insurance tech to food tech now.
Wow, that's quite a journey there. And so you say you did your PhD at Northwestern in Evanston, and now, because of Slice, you're now based in New York. Is that correct?
That is totally correct. Yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, given that, let's talk a little bit more about your career path, because for the listeners, that is a big reason why I'm so glad you were able to join us today. I mean, the term data scientist, it feels like it's been around forever because we hear about it so much, but it's a relatively new role. And so what that means is that it wasn't really anyone's childhood dream job because it didn't exist at the time. And as a result, you know, this is very similar to the tech industry back in the 1990s, in that we're seeing people take a lot of different paths into this field that we now call data science or machine learning or AI, whatever we call it this week. You know, everything from software developer to people who studied the hard sciences to economists or that sort of thing. For those coming from academia with advanced degrees, we tend to hear two stories, right? It's either one, they meet the prospective employer who says, oh, person with a PhD in a science field equals instant data science credibility. Great, come on in, you're hired. The other story is people coming from academia, oh, we feel they need some additional credentialing before they can take on a role in the commercial sector because academia and the commercial world are so different. And so what that means for a lot of people coming from academia who are interested in joining the data science world in the commercial sector, they're probably wondering what to do and which of these paths is more true or that sort of thing. So given that, I'd like to talk about your path from academia into industry. And we can start with your original plan. When you decided at some point, I'm going to get this PhD in physics, your original path was what?
Well, so when I applied to grad schools, my entire thing, I think like since my childhood, my entire thing has been, I just want to study physics, right? And I didn't necessarily think about, oh, once you're done studying at some point, you're supposed to do a job that makes you a contributor member of the society, right? And so I was kind of like always in this, that I have to study physics, I have to understand this better, I have to constantly keep understanding this better. That's why I went to grad school, right? But while I was there and I was more exposed to like, you know, what else exists in the world, right? I started finding things that intrigue me more. I started realizing that I like tangible results on things. I like to see the effect of the work that I'm doing. So I started taking more business classes and I got into this program that Northwestern is like really generous about. It's a program called Management for Scientists and Engineers. What they do is that they select a few students from around their different PhD programs, put them in like this condensed MBA on steroids kind of a program through for like a few weeks in summer. And you just basically learn whatever the Kellogg MBAs would learn, right? And the more I, you know, as I was going through those classes, I started realizing like, oh, all of the things that I do right now can be, you know, if you change your perspective, they're useful in this other different way, right? So what I was learning was that while doing my PhD, you take a very big abstract problem, you break it down into pieces and really hone in on one of those, right? But if you start thinking of this in a business perspective, you're really doing pretty much the same thing, but you're doing it with the idea of like, we have to build something. There's like an end goal, there's an end target. And that appealed to me a lot more than knowing that my research would be useful in like, you know, 20 years from now. That was a hard pill for me to swallow. So as I matured into my graduate research and learned more about the work, also living in Chicago was really helpful because I could then see people do different things. I could see, I could experience the tech world. So I started being more like, you know, I started leaning more towards industry. At that point, I didn't really know what I wanted to do in industry. So I looked into consulting, which excited me, but didn't really like quench that thirst. Like, how do we take something to completion and like really align with it? It's a very fast moving industry and it just wasn't for me. So I just started thinking more about it. My husband, who is a software engineer, he was like, why don't you think about data science? And I was like, what is data science? I play with data all day and I'm a scientist. I don't know how these two things come together. So then I started looking into it. And the fun thing was he had written a book several years ago called Mahout in Action. And I had done the proofreading for it. So I started looking into like, you know, machine learning algorithms. I was like, oh, I know this because I had proofread his book end to end like several times. So I knew what k-means clustering meant and what the mechanism behind it was. So like going through all that, it was kind of like, you know, all these repressed memories from 5 years ago coming back. And the more I looked into it, the more it was apparent that my skills that I was learning during my PhD were just like very directly transferable. So I knew statistics. That's what you need to be a data scientist. I knew how to write code. That's what you need to be a data scientist. I knew how to take a very vague, fast problem and break it down and say, these are the actionable parts of it. And this is what we're going to do about them. That's what you do as a data scientist. So these all these things kind of came together and I got my first data science job right out of school.
Wow. So let me pause there for 1 second. A couple of questions to ask you about that great story. So step one, I do find it very interesting that you were able to spot how the skills you had from the world of physics were transferable elsewhere. I think that's a really good skill in general to be able to see those parallels between different fields. Something listeners of this podcast, I'm sure they're tired of hearing from me, is the number of parallels between the world of the financial markets and data science. It's very much the same concept of what I call analyzing data for fun and profit, right? You have some sort of real world phenomena you're trying to back into some sort of mathematical formula or what have you for some business purposes. And that sort of takes me back to my second point, which is you mentioned this course you had at Northwestern where you were effectively picking up all of these MBA skills. That sounds absolutely fascinating. Like, how did you find that program or how did it find you?
I had kind of always known about it because I had seen a lot of people do that before me. So that was really great. And I had working in like, you know, I was very active in the student community, in the grassroots associations, et cetera. And therein, like the more leaders that I met with, the more I knew that they were taking these courses before me, and they found that immensely beneficial. So I kind of always knew about that course and I really, really wanted to do it. So I applied for it. And I think, I don't know how it works now, but back in the day, that's the way it worked was you had to get a list of like recommendations from a couple of different professors or like people from outside that it worked with. At the time, I was also volunteering for a distant education program in India. So I was kind of like learning about like how business operations work, although that was a not-for-profit organization. I was still learning like, you know, how does branding work? How does marketing work? How do you make, like, how do you operationalize things? So I got a lot of good perspective from there. And all those kind of things kind of like came together as in like, I got my recommendation letters from the people that I'd worked with. And I really knew about the program before, and I knew how it was really effective for a lot of people who worked in wet labs and chemistry, right? And that really helped them get into industry better. So it was kind of like always on my radar.
Interesting. And building on that then, you know, what do you think was the biggest takeaway you had or the most helpful thing you learned in that program that you're able to apply to your data science work today?
Oh, that's a great question. It's been a really long time since it melts together. But I think the thing that I learned the most there was that, you know, we can all take problems and solve them until the end of, you know, our lifetime. And that's what we do in physics. I was really working on a very specific problem, which was about how do you make an ultra sensitive atomic gyroscope using a very specific Heisenberg phenomenon, right? And that was just like a very pointed topic, which it's still in progress. There are people in my lab who are still working on it, right? And that's just the pure joy of science. But what I learned through the Management for Scientists and Engineers program was that for the real world to work, for like, you know, things to be productive and for businesses to run, you really have to figure out like, what's the so what of this problem, right? Why are we solving this? Not so much as how are we going to solve this, as in like what algorithm we're going to use. That's kind of like the back end work of it. But at the very first step, you have to really figure out why are, like, what's the problem space? Why are we solving this? And what's the return on investment of doing this, right? Like, am I building this algorithm because my clients just want something to do with data, which often ends up being the case? Or I'm solving this because it really solves a real world problem. And is there a dollar tag attached to it?
Got it. And building on that then, speaking of problems, what about this problem of finding your first job out of grad school? Like you said, so you have the PhD, at least you're approaching your PhD, and you've gone through these courses where you've learned a lot about the business impact of data, and you're starting to think about data science as a role. But then you had to make that leap, and that's probably a two-part leap, right? The first part was making that formal decision to leave academia and leave science. And from there, looking for that first job out of school and trying to convince a prospective employer that, yes, I've spent several years in a lab, but I'm still very much qualified for the role you have here. What was it like looking for that first job and like, how did you find it?
Obviously, coming right out of it, I was petrified. I was worried that, hey, I don't have the, you know, I have all these like skills that I know correctly on paper, but am I like actually appropriately armed for this role, right? What I realized was that it really matters that you put in the time to do the work, to do the actual work. So as an entry-level data scientist, you will not be making the big decisions for the company. You will not even be making the big decisions for your team. What you will be doing though, is somebody will give you a very specific problem and you will find 1,000 ways of looking at the data and then building a model. How do you do that? There are lots of opportunities out there. There are lots of free resources out there. There's lots of like YouTube videos, lectures, tutorials, tons of things out there. So I picked up on all of those. Then I also started doing Kaggle competitions, which really helped me because not just because I was there playing with the data all day. The Kaggle forums are very useful and I still go back to them to this day to understand like, hey, this is a very specific problem that I've I've hit a wall. What are other people around the world doing about this specific problem, right? You're kind of in it with a lot of other people, so you don't feel isolated and like you're solving the biggest problem in the world all by yourself. So doing Kaggle, and then there's another form called Driven Data. All of these, like picking up random problems to solve in real time with other people while we were like kind of like really trying to understand the very basics of data science that you wouldn't necessarily learn from like listening to lectures, right? You're getting your hands dirty and playing with it. And that's something that I found very valuable. That's what kind of got me through the door for my first job. And that's what really helped me, like having that understanding of real data can be messy. Real data can be really, really sometimes disappointing or deceiving. That really helped me gain that perspective. That really helped me go through all the interviews very well. And that was my first job. My first year, that's what I did. I was given a ton of data and I just played around with it and told people that this is what I'm seeing, this is what I'm not seeing. And just kind of like evolved from there.
That makes sense then. And so like you said, you're at your first job and this was at the insurance company. By that point, you hadn't worked in insurance before. So how much of a learning curve was there for you?
So it's not an insurance company. It's a company that works with insurance providers, right? So we build software solutions from them. So quite distinctly different from insurance companies, but similar in the sense that we're basically dealing with their data and their regulations. And it's insurance being one of the oldest living businesses is very, very behind on technology. So that was one really big challenge that we had to, you know, overcome. What I learned was that having played around on Kaggle, I had worked on like data sets from banks. I had worked on data sets from I had worked on a very interesting data set about water levels in Africa, right? And so these were like different kinds of things, which while it wasn't easy, I would say, because you really do have to study a lot to catch up with insurance and like its regulations, you also have to realize that it's a very vast thing. And just be confident about it and say that I will learn as I come, you know, as I encounter more problems. You will never know 100% of whatever insurance is. So while in the beginning, I kind of like treaded into it with a little bit of trepidation, I realized that the support system was really great. There were other people who also joined as PhDs maybe a year before me. And my colleagues were really cool about, you know, teaching me the things that they had learned the hard way. But I would say, that's what PhD gives you, kind of like just stepping into the unknown without a lot of fear, knowing that I know the basics. What I need to do is learn all the trappings of the insurance world, which will come to me slowly but surely. And that's how I rolled with it, kind of rolled with the punches, basically.
Yeah, I could definitely see that. And you had a lot of punches to deal with at that point, because you're going from academia to industry. And you also dove straight into a highly regulated field. I mean, insurance is right up there with my old stomping grounds of banking, where you just have a lot of rules everywhere. Did you find working in a regulated field to be very difficult as a data scientist, or did you even really notice the regulations at that point?
Well, it kind of became a part of the habit, right? That this is a very highly regulated field. So I have to be very conscious of what I can or cannot do. Mm-hmm. But then once you figure out what you can do, you get into the habit of like really communicating with the legal team, for example. So about like beginning of last year when the California Information Protection Act.
Mm-hmm. CCPA, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. I couldn't remember that term. But CCPA, yeah, it was like a big part of my life for over a year, because we were trying to figure out like how do we sanitize and anonymize data to make it more CCPA and GDPR compliant, right? And the more you think about it, the more it is really communicating what you're doing with the data. As I had evolved into my role over the years, I also learned the tricks of the trade, where it was really about communicating to people who do not do data science, who do not have a technical background. So a lot of my job also involved communicating what we're going to do with the data, what is necessary for us, why is this important to our legal teams. So yeah, like going back to your original question about was it restrictive? In some ways, sometimes it is, but once you figure out the realm of what you can do and with like the ingredients that are available to you, then it's quite freeing. You just have to acknowledge the fact that these are the things that I cannot and should not do for a good reason.
Yeah, all of that aligns with what else I've heard from between my own experience working with legal professionals in this field. And also we had a guest on a few months ago, Shane Glenn. He's an attorney out in the Bay Area who works a lot with firms doing AI. And he said pretty much the same thing, which is communication is key, right? You have to, as a data scientist, expect that at some point, someone's going to knock on your door and ask all those really tough questions such as, hey, where did you get that training data? And where is it going? And can you tell me what's in it? And so on and so forth. I think for data scientists who aren't used to working in that sort of regulated field, if they're not accustomed to having someone, for very good reason, constantly asking them what's in the data and why, it can seem a little unnerving.
Oh, for sure. For sure. But I think, like you said, communication is key. I think it goes both ways, right? It's a two-way street. If the legal team can tell you that maybe do not use econometric data because it generates a bias in your model, wherein, for example, for an insurance company, maybe the kind of premiums that they decide on based on whatever models, not the work that I was doing, but I'm just like hypothetically a model. If that generates bias because we know that certain zip codes are less economically well-to-do, there are some zip codes that maybe have like a greater density of a certain race, et cetera. And so your model can just, and as a data scientist, maybe you do not mean any harm. In most cases, people don't mean any harm, but they just don't know where the bias in their model is coming from. And there are lots of interesting studies that have been done in the recent few years where people really dived into the model and took a look at how this impacts communities that are already underprivileged. I think if you can have this like path of communication open and well-greased, people more often than not will say, I understand this is a variable that would have given me a lot of good results, would have made my model better, but these are the real world implications of it. And it's all right that I cannot use it.
Absolutely. I think that's a very valuable lesson for data scientists and also, quite frankly, those who employ them to take home. You know, that sometimes just because the data is within reach doesn't mean it's necessarily usable. And even if it's usable, it doesn't necessarily mean it's appropriate. So
exactly, yeah.
Now, something you said a few minutes ago I found very interesting. You talked about how all of your work getting that PhD actually prepared you for working in the commercial sector, because like you said, it taught you how to roll with the punches and it taught you how to dive into a new field and start exploring and that sort of thing. So given that, you know, a debate we've heard a lot in the data science world is this question of whether the role of a data scientist requires an advanced degree or whether that's just an old trope from the early days of data science when, oh, the first data scientists had PhDs and therefore everyone just assumed PhD data science is a data scientist. What's your take on that? Do you think the role of data scientist requires a PhD?
If we were to say, you know, in hard and fast terms, if it requires a PhD, I would say totally not, right? It really depends on the candidate. At the end of the day, is that like the things that I'm looking for when I want to work with other data scientists, what I want to look for is this person going to ask the right questions? Right? Are they going to ask why we're building this model, how we're building this model, what's the point of building this model, right? And just because we can build this model, should we build it, or is there an easier way of solving this problem? So are they going to ask me the right questions? And once we decide on something, will they ask further probing questions and make actionable decisions on them, right? All of this is based on the fact that they already know. They already have the skills, the hard skills that they need to do, right? That they need to have, which are, they need to know machine learning. They need to know how to write code. They need to understand statistics and they need to be able to communicate these well. So with all these hard skills, do I have this like hierarchy of sort of like a pyramid of, are they asking the right questions? And secondly, are they good enough are they good enough with humility to say, I don't know the answer, because none of us knows all the answers. Are they able to say, I don't know the answer, let me go figure this out? Are they going to learn on the job, right? Or are they going to come in and say, I know all the algorithms that exist in the world and I'm just going to apply one of them, whatever the problem is. And I'm just going to do just put 72 transformers, and that's what the model is going to do. It's just going to have 72 transformers in there, and I'm going to need this amount of GPU, and I'm going to need this and that, right? So do you need a PhD? Absolutely not. Do you need a master's degree? Absolutely not. Do these things help you? Do these degrees help you develop a certain amount of maturity and certain amount of like, does it train you into asking the right questions? Totally. But can somebody right out of high school, if they worked as interns and they went and put in the amount of work to really figure out what is the problem, will they be good enough for an entry-level job? Totally. Right. At the end of the day, it's about what skills you have. I've worked with some data scientists who've come from non-name brand universities, so to speak. Right. Mm-hmm. And they have been fantastic. They've been great co-workers. They've been, you know, totally my person's Friday, where I can just like turn around and say, I need this problem solved. Can you do this? Or here's a project. Can you take care of it? Right. And they've been perfect at it. They've been so it's so satisfying to work with those people. Have I worked with PhDs who've taken a lot of work from me as a manager to get them onboarded, explain the problem to them, and then just like them working on something for the longest time and have analysis paralysis and keep continuing to build that model until it's like perfect? That's not helpful. So I think the short answer is no, but it totally depends on the person at the end of the day. What kind of candidate would they end up being? Unfortunately, for the sake of time, recruiters need to have certain filters, right? They can't just go through every, like they can't personally interview every person. But I do tend to, like in the roles that I hire for, I tend to look at like what is there in their entire resume? What have they worked on? And those are the questions I like to ask more than about like, oh, do you have a PhD in this like very obscure thing? Because I know how that feels. But yeah, it totally depends.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And that really aligns with some of my experience during the dot-com era. You had a lot of companies that figured, oh, if you want to be a software developer, you must have a computer science degree. And it's very similar to what you described, which is there are people out there. I mean, this is right around the time where open source was really taking off, and therefore the tools were free. Anyone who had the time could apply themselves to learning the skills as far as writing software. And quite frankly, I didn't see any difference in quality in the candidates I interviewed or the people with whom I worked based on whether they had a comp sci degree or not. In fact, what I did find was that there were a number of people who had computer science degrees who, like you were talking about, having to put in extra work to onboard some of the PhDs. Same deal, which is they've spent the last 4 years learning how to build something in a very specific fashion. They weren't accustomed to having to maintain their code. They weren't accustomed to having to use third-party libraries instead of writing everything homegrown. And that took a lot of extra onboarding. So that definitely aligns there. Also, something else that really stands out, it sounds like what you're saying, if I can put some words in your mouth, is that the PhD or the master's degree in a science or whatever, a lot of what that really gives you is the research mindset. Because a lot of good data science, you know, I like to joke about putting the science back in data science, right? And a lot of good data science, it really involves that scientific mindset of, here is a problem. We're going to look into it. We're going to apply some really rigorous thought around it. And also, like a good researcher, you know that there is no guarantee that what you're looking for will actually come out. And I think for a data scientist to know that I can throw all of my time and effort into building this model and it might not perform, it's disappointing, but I think it's very helpful for them to know from the start that is one possible outcome.
Right. And the way I like to frame it with my team is that, oh, that's a hypothesis. What happens to hypotheses, right? They can either be right or they can be wrong, or you just are not conclusively able to prove either or either way, right? And so anytime they say this should work, what I typically say is that's a hypothesis. Let's try it. Like there's no cost of trying. So try this, try adding this, try doing this, right? And the research mindset that totally comes into play, you're absolutely right, is that knowing that things will fail more often than not, right? Mostly they will fail. And we're okay with that. We should learn to be okay with going back to our stakeholders and saying, listen, we understand that this is what you're saying, but this is what the data is showing us. And this is what the model is telling us. Maybe the model is doing well, but it just doesn't perform to the level that we need for it to be useful. And therefore, I don't think we should do this. Like, before we spend any more resources on building this or deploying this, we should just decide this is not the approach we're going to take. One, the other skill that one needs to learn as a data scientist is how do you effectively communicate that to a certain specific audience who may or may not know data science, or in most cases will just really not know what machine learning is.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. And now that you're in a leadership role, I think that is doubly helpful, because when you're tasking out work to your team, you as a manager have to be able to explain to the people above you in the food chain that, yes, we're going to try these experiments. They may not work. You may have to set expectations accordingly. And moving the other way, when you're talking to your direct reports, that involves you having to set, I guess you could say, time barriers and effort barriers around the work you're doing. You can say, look, we know this might not work. Therefore, please spend X number of days or weeks looking into this. And after that, if we're not seeing performance, we have to pull the plug. Would you say that matches your experience?
Yeah, totally. Oftentimes it'll just be like, we're going to build this, take 2 weeks to experiment. And you have several checkpoints in those 2 weeks to figure out like what's the health of that experiment. And in 2 weeks, we decide, okay, we've put this amount of effort and this is commensurate with what, you know, what our other competing priorities might be. So let's move on. Maybe, and you know, a lot of times it's also that this project is not completely dead, it's just being put on the back burner because maybe you need to collect data for 6 months. And that's when the model will get better, right? Just because you have data from the last 10 years doesn't mean that that would be applicable today. So maybe we need more recent data to build this. So kind of making that decision is also key for us in my role to be able to say, we're just not going to do this ever, unfortunately, because this is just not going to show us any signal. We've done all the due diligence on this. Or sometimes being able to say, let's come back to it. Very rarely saying, this works, this is perfect, let's take it to the next one, right? And that's just the life cycle of an experiment, and you have to be okay with that. And that's what like doing a PhD tells you, you fail mostly. And then when you get a signal, you really have to figure out if this is a signal or if this is just false noise.
Absolutely. And I think someone related to you in a leadership role, having to explain both up and down. Let's talk a little bit more about your work at Slice. So you mentioned that at Slice, you're head of the machine learning for personalization. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what you're doing more day to day?
Yeah, for sure. So just to kick that off, let's talk about what Slice is.
Perfect. Right?
So Slice is a company that provides a digital platform for mom and pop local pizzerias, which helps them compete with chains like Domino's and Papa John's, who kind of, even though they have a good enough market share, but nothing compared to if you were to like put together all the local pizzerias in this country. But where they win is that they have a really great online presence, right? So it's the ease of ordering for somebody. If I'm hanging out with my friends, it's 11 p.m. on a Friday, I'd be like, okay, let me just, you know, I don't want to call Papa John's. I want to go to their website and place an order, right? That's something that doesn't exist for most local pizzerias. And actually, quite honestly, for most local restaurants, right? They want to be in the business of food. They don't have the time, resources, or the skills to actually have a web presence. So what Slice does is, it provides them with that web presence so that it becomes easier for the customer to get their favorite pizza from a local pizzeria rather than having to go to one of the big chains, right? And that really helps. It kind of like makes the difference between somebody being able to keep running their business or sending their kids to college, et cetera, right? So it has a really big impact. That's what Slice does. Where I come in on Slice is, if you were to go on the Slice app, how do I present you with an experience that is so you? Maybe you like pizza with anchovies and artichokes on them for whatever reasons, but that's you. That's very specific to you. So how do we make sure that you have that experience where when you're hungry and you're on the app, you're not really running around to figure out where exactly can I get my food from and what food do I want to eat? But more like, I'm hungry. This is the food I want to eat right here. Now my food will be here in 30 minutes or whatever, right? That's the experience that my team works towards building for Slice.
Makes sense to me. So it sounds like Slice's mission overall, it's about covering the long tail of pizza, if you will, right? If the big chains are more for the fat head, there's still tons of pizzerias in the tail. It's just, they're not as discoverable because they don't have the web presence. Like you said, they don't have the slick application where someone can say, I'm in this location, I have these tastes, where do I go? Right.
Exactly. And how do you equitably give them that tool? Like, how do you arm them in a way that it doesn't take away, like, you know, 30% of their revenue? How do you make sure that that pricing is in place, that this is actually a solution that works for them, right? And they're not, they make the most out of it.
Building on that, let's talk about your work specifically. So you said you focus on the personalization, the idea that I log into Slice and I know I'm in this location, I have this sort of taste profile, for lack of a better term, what's nearby. So without, I know you can't talk much about the secret sauce that goes into it, but I'm sure you, as someone on the personalization team, you're faced with having to balance between getting better and better at finding specifically what people want, but at the same time, providing a bit more serendipity in that discovery and offering things that, well, they haven't looked for this specific flavor profile before, but they might like this, because that benefits the consumer as far as being able to try something new, or maybe try something that they have liked before, they just haven't purchased through Slice. And it also helps these pizzerias, because it means that people who didn't know they were going to like this flavor combination, they're going to go buy. So would you say that's true about your job, that you have to balance between the focus of a recommendation engine versus the discovery?
Yeah, for sure. I think discovery is really one of the biggest parts of, you know, how we experience food, right? Some people are very specific. They know exactly this is what I eat and this is exactly what I'm going to continue eating. And that works for them. And that's great. And that's another thing that you have to learn about this. But then there's also, you know, people like me personally, I want to figure out what's the best food in this neighborhood. I have this, like, major FOMO of missing out on best food in the neighborhood. So to constantly know if I'm here, right here at this intersection, I want to know what's the best food that I can have. So if I'm on Slice, I want to know the best local pizzeria around me. I need to know what's their best stuff. It doesn't have to be exactly what I eat all the time. So I think when you build models, you have to kind of figure out what problem you're solving for. Are you solving for the first case that we talked about? Or are we solving for the second case we talked about? Sometimes they kind of go hand in hand and you will build one model that just like solves everything. More often than not, that is not going to be the case. And so it then comes down to like app design and user experience about how do you give that person who's a hunter rather than a gatherer, how do you give them that experience, right? And like you said, cannot talk about the secret pizza sauce here, but these are pretty much all the toppings that go into it if I want to continue this very stupid pun.
You know what? I'm all for pizza analogies, although now it's making me hungry. But there's I laughed a minute ago. There's something you said that really struck me when you talked about, you know, one model won't solve everything. I think for a lot of entry-level data scientists, that's probably one of the bigger shocks they meet in the workplace, which is, no, we're not going to have one model. We're going to have multiple models. Sometimes we might have multiple models working on different aspects of the same problem, right?
Yep. That's a hard thing to come to terms with. In the beginning, what you say is, oh, we have trillions of data points from all these years. Let me open my magic, you know, deep learning network and punch everything in. We're going to normalize the data. We're going to standardize it. And I'm going to let it run for a week on like several hundred GPUs. It's going to cost a lot, but that's one solution. It's a one-time investment. And here's a solution. And what it does is maybe it'll give you some good results, but what you need to understand in industry is that you're not solving one problem. You're trying to balance many, many, many problems. They kind of do not disturb each other. So you need independent models to solve independent pieces of the problem. And oftentimes you have to think of these as building blocks, as Lego pieces that kind of come together. One of the great things about thinking about this problem is that maybe you'll build five models, right? For example, but you can take any whatsoever combinations of those to solve a certain problem. And therefore, maybe with five models, you're able to solve 20 problems. Whereas if you were try and build one model, which will maybe not mostly, in most cases, wouldn't be robust, will break a lot of times. And if that one model breaks, everything breaks down, you're going to be in hot soup. right? So you have to really think about what are the moving pieces here? How do I break them down? It's not ever going to be one size fits all. That doesn't happen for clothing. That doesn't happen for shoes. Doesn't happen for pizza. So why should it happen for machine learning?
That sounds like a sort of wisdom you pass down to new hires. I mean, all jokes aside, so we've talked about your journey. You've gone from the PhD program in physics, and then you found your way to this world of data science. You were an entry-level data science. And then shortly after that, you moved into a management role. And now you're in yet another leadership role, which means you're probably transitioning out of doing more of the hands-on technical work, right?
Yeah, it's very surprising how I do, but I try to, like, you know, I try my best to find some time every week. And sometimes that happens to be on weekends, but I just really want to make sure that I know what the data is. Like, I know what, if my team is working on certain problems, I want to be able to understand what the real hands-on problems with this data might be. And that also helps, like, for a small team, helps in like idea generation. Sometimes we just really, you know, you can't just have two people working on five different things. You need another head to think about, okay, maybe this is one point that we just kind of glossed over or missed. And at the end of the day, all said and done, I'm still a scientist. So I see data. I just really want to touch it. That's very specific to me problem. But that's it. You do have to maintain that balance, to be honest. I mean, you don't want to get rusty with the data, right? Like, you don't want to get rusty. You want to always constantly upskill yourself, up level on whatever skills that exist in the market. So you want to touch the data. You want to play around with it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you also want to strike that balance between taking on more of the leadership duties versus keeping your hands dirty in the code, which I guess that means you spend a decent amount of time passing along some of this knowledge to the people on your team, the up and coming data scientists. So instead of you being able to do all the work, you can say, look, you might want to approach it this way, or in the past, I've hit this sort of problem. Watch out for that.
Totally. There's not one specific session where it's like, you know, Resham giving wisdom to all the newbies session, which I would have loved for something to be dedicated to me. But these come, you know, and that's another reason why I love being able to be hands-on, like being able to set some time apart. And I really try to make that effort to make sure that I'm playing with the data. Or I'll say, hey, this is a comparatively lower priority project. Why don't I work on it? Because the timeline of that would be more stretched. That way I can understand the nuances of, like, generally what data does Slice have, or generally what data did CCC have when I worked there. So, and all of these things come in handy when we're having more discussions about the progress of the project, or somebody hits a roadblock. And again, communication is key. One of the things that I have learned is that it is tempting to be in a position where somebody gives you a problem, your manager gives you a problem, and you want to take it and be the superhero of that, and just, like, you know, go into your bat cave for a week and solve it and reemerge with, like, aha, I have a solution. That sounds very romantic and probably something that you could potentially do for a little while in grad school, but more often than not, it doesn't work. It doesn't work because there's not one single person who knows the answer to every question. And there are things that are so dynamic in the real world, in the real data place, that maybe you get some inputs from other stakeholders, from marketing, from legal, from sales or whatnot, depending on whatever problem you're trying to solve. And so retreating into your bat cave, while it's very comforting to think about, it's actually more helpful to constantly have these updates and communicate that when you hit a roadblock, you're able to, you know, have that humility to say, I don't know the answer. Can somebody explain this to me?
Right. It's almost as though you're recreating your old physics lab just inside a data science department.
Oh, yeah, totally. With more light around me, because I worked in for a long time.
Yeah, more light, more windows, more outside time. So given that you've been very generous with your time, I didn't want to take up much more of your afternoon here. But one other question I did have is, you were talking about your team at Slice being a fairly small one. I mean, how big is your team at Slice taking on all of this work of personalizing in the pizza world?
So right now it's a very small team. I lead a team of two other data scientists, and we're hiring one more in our Belfast office, but definitely looking to expand this more in the next 1 year or so.
Excellent. And I know you touched on some of this earlier, but when you're looking for a candidate, what are the sorts of qualities you're looking for?
If I were to boil this down into just a phrase, I would say can-do attitude. It sounds, you know, corny, but really that's what you need. This is all assuming that you know machine learning, you know the principles with which it works. You know, you wouldn't make really rookie mistakes that somebody doing machine learning 101 would do. You know how to study your data set and what are the best practices. But maybe you don't know all of the sophisticated new models. And what I want to see is that if you know all of these things, are you willing to say, I don't know for the rest of the things? And are you able to work with me on trying to figure the problem out? A lot of our skills are knowledge-based and they are learnable on the job. What I really need to know is that, have you learned how to learn? Because that's what's going to really keep you afloat. And that's what's going to be the most useful for the rest of the team.
That sounds great. Well, Dr. Sarkar, thank you again so much for your time. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Thank you, as always, for listening to today's episode. I've been your host, Hugh McCallum, Senior Content Advisor at Formulated By. And as always, I would like to thank the Formulated By production team for taking care of the audio and all the other heavy lifting that makes this podcast possible. Now, Formulated By is the company behind the Data Science Salon events. These are multi-day events where leading data scientists share their experience, expertise, and best practices on how to apply AI and machine learning to different industries. We have a number of events taking place this year, including one in May on applying AI and machine learning to media, advertising, and entertainment, and another in August on retail and e-commerce, as well as one in December on finance and technology. So if you're interested in attending, you can check out the Data Science Salon website, that's datascience.salon, for the full schedule and registration. We hope to see you there.